There are powerful and unaccountable leaders in charge of our national security state, and U.S. citizens have effectively been cut out of national security decision-making. That is the premise of the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, published by Nation Books. The author of this work, Scott Horton, joins me today on The Kathleen Dunn Show to talk about this issue. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Scott Horton is a New York attorney known for his work in emerging markets and international law, especially human rights law and the law of armed conflict. He lectures at Columbia Law School. Scott Horton, welcome to The Kathleen Dunn Show.
John, great to be with you.
You know, I think we probably all understand that there are certain things that go on in government, particularly as it applies to foreign policy or intelligence gathering, that we're not privy to, and in some cases with very good reason. And a certain amount of secrecy is inherent to any bureaucracy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no government on the planet today, nor in history, that's existed without using secrets to some degree.
Nor any corporation, for that matter. I mean, or any business. You have trade secrets. You have secret recipes for Kentucky Fried Chicken, the secret recipe for Coca-Cola, and so forth. There are a lot of secrets out there. Not all of them are unhealthy. So a certain degree of secrecy is beneficial. But when does it become harmful?
And it becomes harmful, particularly in the national security area, when it is so pervasive that there's not enough information to allow people to have good discussions and to make judgments about policies. So one clear break or distinction we can draw has to do with tactical versus strategic use of secrecy. So, you know, the fact that an individual mujahideen or terrorist leader is being targeted on a specific date at a specific site using a certain weapon, of course, all the information surrounding that planned action can legitimately be called secret and be kept out of the public sphere, and the public doesn't really have any reasonable right to know that information. But now let's step back and assume that the CIA is engaging on a 10-year-long military campaign attacking terrorist leaders in a foreign country that will involve hundreds of strikes over a long period of time, may result in thousands of casualties, with results that are unpredictable or that may not be the results that the CIA saw for itself. That constitutes a long-term military engagement or a war, and that's exactly the sort of thing the public is entitled to know about, to have discussions, forced discussions of, and to have the Congress be involved ultimately also in some sort of decision-making.
Who are the Lords of Secrecy?
The Lords of Secrecy are the in the American system, they are the senior echelons of leadership of the nation's national security and intelligence agency, who have the power to create secrets. This is given under federal law. And they use that power for, in some entirely legitimate purposes, to keep military and diplomatic secrets, for instance. But they also use them frequently and increasingly for illegitimate purposes, which is to cover up mistakes, errors, corruption, or even criminality.
And you you cite any number of examples of that in your book. The desire to cover up or to cover up a mistake is also kind of an inherent part of bureaucratic secrecy. I mean, we certainly see it in everyday life, in not in situations involving the national security, but in it's sort of an inherent part of how we behave as humans in a bureaucratic situation. Something goes wrong, and somebody's going to get blamed, and you want to make sure it isn't you.
That's exactly right. It's a natural instinct. And my book, actually, I start my book with discussions of things that went on in ancient Athens in the 4th and 5th centuries before the Common Era. And then I look at this theory of bureaucratic use of secrecy, which was developed more than 100 years ago by sociologists writing in Germany. So not really looking at America at all or at the CIA, but looking at particularly national security bureaucracies in Germany in the period before World War I. And I walk through the the rules that they derived from their extensive study about how secrecy predictably would be used. And I then take those rules and apply them to what's happened in the U.S. over the last 15 years and point out that, yeah, so everything that they predicted would happen has happened.
Well, one of the things you point out as you summarize some of the work of some of these sociologists, and I think it's interesting that this came from Germany because wasn't it von Bismarck who invented the bureaucracy? I just wanted to read a short passage here and talk about this for just a moment. Let's see. Here we go. A significant part of Simmel's analysis can be applied with equal force to government structures delving in secrecy, such as intelligence services and law enforcement agencies. Secrecy, he says, leads an organization to an increasingly pyramidal hierarchical structure in which the sharing of secrets is restricted progressively from the top to the bottom. And that's kind of that's a major issue. I mean, information is power, and the more information you have, the more power you have, and the more you can withhold from someone else, that also increases this power. But that can become really dangerous if only a few people know about something, can't it?
That's exactly right. And in the major American reviews that were done later of the use of bureaucratic secrecy, particularly the one by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, he concluded that that this stovepiping process had led repeatedly to the critical decision makers in America not being informed of secrets that they needed to know in making decisions. And particularly, he cites a number of cases where Congress wasn't informed and it therefore couldn't take things into account. But even worse, where the president repeatedly wasn't informed, and the president therefore took a whole series of decisions not knowing about secret information that could well have caused him to decide things differently.
Well, and I think the national security apparatus is part of the executive branch of government, but Congress is supposed to be providing oversight. Is that actually happening? And if not, why not? And give us some examples.
Well, I think it's extremely clear now that there is very, very weak oversight provided, particularly of the intelligence community. And I think, you know, the really striking example of this is the Dianne Feinstein committee report that was just issued in the final days of the last Congress. Got a lot of attention. This was a review of the use of torture and black sites. And this example cuts in two directions. So it is simultaneously the best congressional study ever done of a single intelligence community program. It goes into things in tremendous detail and was meticulously prepared. So it's something of a gold standard for reviews. But it also documents the fact that there was no real-time oversight performed by any of these congressional organs. So this report was picked up 9 years after the program in question had been terminated by the CIA. So it's a historical footnote, not an attempt to deal with something that was actually going on by the agency. And the report documents in tremendous detail how while this program was in play, Congress asked a few superficial questions, got largely incorrect responses to them or no responses at all, and failed to follow up on any of that. So it basically documents Congress's own failure to perform oversight. And today, when we look at the congressional intelligence community leadership, you know, both Democrats and Republicans, I think one point in which they're all agreed is that oversight has been very weak.
And I don't want to be put in the position of defending Congress, God forbid. But to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, how can you know what you don't know? I mean, how do you know if you don't know what questions to ask? It's pretty tough to ask the right question. You've got to have some kind of a lever there or some piece of information that allows you to ask the next question to uncover another piece of information.
That's right. In fact, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, amazingly, is something of a hero in this area. He's someone who, you know, sat at the apex of the defense community for a long time, serving as Secretary of Defense in two separate terms. And he vehemently ridiculed the constant use of secrecy by people underneath him, at one point scribbling in the margins, "What next, the cafeteria menu to be marked secret?" So I think he had fundamentally correct ideas about this. But the oversight dilemma is exactly what you point out. And this is something that, in fact, many of the critics have pointed to. So congressional oversight is the most effective theoretical way to check secrecy while preserving important secrets. But in order to be able to perform appropriate oversight, the committee has to command tremendous technical information and understanding, knowledge, and experience. Otherwise, it's just completely outflanked by the intelligence community people itself. And it's very, very difficult for them to recruit the right people with the right levels of experience. They attempt to do it, but they lag far behind. So
well, and they're dealing with people whose business it is to obfuscate.
That's exactly right. So I would say it's not just the United States. All around the world today, we see democracies have a problem dealing with their intelligence communities. In fact, just in this last week, there's a huge uproar going on right now in Argentina, where the president is demanding disbanding the intelligence agency and firing its chief. And there have been similar controversies in many, many other states. And in part, this goes back to exactly the problem you just note. That is, these organs, they're trained to obfuscate, to lie, to dissemble. And they are given permission to use those skills when dealing with other governments. Well, the problem you've always got to be concerned about is what happens if they turn those skills on their government. And I think we saw that with the Feinstein Committee and the pushback from the CIA. There's no doubt that in the final stages, that's exactly what the CIA is doing. They are using all their tricks and their tradecraft to try and block that report from being issued. So they've turned their guns on their own government.
We're talking about the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. We have the author of that book, Scott Horton, with us. And I invite your participation in this program as well. I'm sure you've got questions for our guest, comments you'd like to make on secrecy issues as it applies specifically to our country. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number, 800-486-8655. You can also use email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And the Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook and Twitter, so you can leave your comment or question there as well. I think we'll take a short break. When we come back, Scott Horton, I'd like you to take us back to the days of the Vietnam War, the late 60s, early 70s, the atmosphere then and how things were conducted, and then compare that to what we see, what we've seen in the last, say, 10 or 15 years and what we're seeing today. I think that might make a pretty interesting conversation for our audience to hear. We'll do that in just a moment. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. She'll be back on Monday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking with Scott Horton, who is the author of the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And with you, if you care to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We will get to some calls in just a moment. But, Scott Horton, before we do that, one of the things that you do in the early part of your book is to draw a pretty sharp contrast between, and I think this goes directly to what we were talking about a little bit ago about congressional oversight, to what happened during the Vietnam era and in the immediate aftermath, and then fast-forwarding to the two Iraq wars and other issues more recently than that, things that have happened during the Obama administration. Take us back and talk about what the situation was in terms of how we as a country responded to what was going on in Vietnam, and then let's talk about how that has changed over time.
Well, I think if we go back to the mid and late 60s, early 1970s, we see a substantially different feel in the country about conflict and war, and a very, very deep, profound public engagement with the question of war and peace in Vietnam, something that Mobilize brought hundreds of thousands of people to the streets and proved the key issue in many, many elections. So whatever view they had, whether they were pro-war or anti-war, Americans on the whole were deeply taken with this issue, and it strongly affected their political judgments and their decisions. And I think if we step back, you know, the Vietnam War was the first war that was really put together and waged by these national security elites, and, you know, that's particularly people like McGeorge Bundy. But the famous best and the brightest around President Kennedy and then around President Johnson, and they really didn't want to have a lot of public debate about this war. They didn't want to have public discussion. They just wanted to do it. They knew best. They avoided that public debate. We had the Tonkin Gulf Resolution at one point, drawing on a mistake about what had happened at the Tonkin Gulf, as we later discovered. And, of course, the same best and brightest later said that had obviously been a huge error, that democratic process was important, and they lost the advantage of having a firm public decision taken in support of the war at any stage along the way. But after the war, there was a huge blowback against these same national security elites. They were questioned. They were ridiculed. There was a very hostile attitude towards them publicly and in Congress. They really began putting together a strategy that focused on identifying the flashpoints, what really triggers American political interest in national security matters. And they figured out, obviously enough, that it was the exposure. It was the fact that brothers and sons and cousins and fathers were put at physical risk on the battlefield, were coming back in body bags or horribly maimed. This was what was electrifying the public and producing deep, deep, deep political interest in the people. So they introduced a multi-phased a reaction to that. And the first phase was to end the draft. So you had a volunteer military drawn largely from exurbia, and from lower middle class, people who were on the fringe of politics. That already began to tone things down. They then moved to much heavier use of contractors rather than uniformed military. You don't report about contractors or contractor deaths, and over time we started receiving less and less information about the deaths of our own soldiers. You know, there were no photographs of the caskets when they returned at Dover Air Force Base. The President and the Secretary of Defense stopped the old practice of sending letters to the families of those who died. And then we move another stage into robotic warfare. So when we had robots leading the military effort, there really was little or almost no risk of physical harm or injury to any American. And I think what we see and what we see in America today is that those assumptions are correct. So this reduction of immediate physical risk to American citizen soldiers also means less public interest and less discussion of these matters. So people may think that the Iraq War was foolish or that the effort in Afghanistan was unreasonable. In fact, there may be overwhelming majorities opposing it, but they don't feel that strongly about it. It doesn't turn out to be the issue that drives their vote in major public elections.
Well, and there's a lot about this that's about marketing and about positioning and about framing. And I wanted to go back to something you said, because I think it's really, really crucial to this, and that is after the Vietnam War, when the draft was ended, although the Selective Service System still exists. Okay, no more draft. But the draft was an enormous piece of the dissatisfaction of a lot of people with the Vietnam War. I mean, and let's face it, we lost 50,000 people killed in that war, and quite a few more injured. There were hundreds of thousands of people who went through Vietnam in those 2-year enlistments of conscription And so you had, that was a major, major thing. And someone said, aha, well, we're not going to go through that again. If we have to have a war, let's make sure that, you know, we only send those who volunteer to go, and then everybody else will shut up. But, I mean, that was one of the things that brought a lot of people out into the streets in the late 60s and early 70s was the draft, because there were so many people being swept up in it. But everything else after that seems to me has been more about, okay, how do we market this? How do we sell it? And what information do we need to let out strategically rather than just kind of being straight with people?
And what information do we need to withhold? So
right.
That's a whole major piece of it. That goes with secrecy. So as one philosopher says, knowledge and information are contagious. So people don't know basic facts. They don't know basic information. There's little meat out there to feed a dialogue or discussion. So if you can take the oxygen out of the room, you can avoid this and get people engaged with other subjects.
Well, and then you talk about the role of technology and how we've made warfare robotic. But that requires, as in most military conflicts, one of the things that's required is that you dehumanize the enemy. So being able to go and kill somebody by remote control seems to be the ultimate dehumanization.
Exactly correct. And, of course, now we even have software providers saying we can eliminate entirely the human and moral element here. We'll just give you programs which we can put into the drones, which will allow the drones to decide who and when to strike. It begins to sound like the script from Terminator, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to note, though, that there are... there are elements, there are organizations, there may even be other countries that wish to do harm to Americans, whether deserved or not. And I don't want to get into, we did this, so they should be able to do that. But you don't have to be paranoid to have enemies. And so there is some need for some sort of security apparatus. What's the balance point here?
Well, that's the key question. But one of them is that basic, golden rule. And we're introducing this technology. We're also writing the rules for this technology. And this is not such a sophisticated leap as the introduction of nuclear weaponry was. Actually, the technological threshold for drones is much, much lower, and there are many other places in the world where there is tremendous, there's nanotechnology and there's drone technology available, which could easily be applied. So I think we can say that within a decade, certainly within two decades, we're going to see a dozen countries around the world with the military drone technology able to apply it the same way we have. And then if we've set a rule that says, we're entitled to use these drones to go after and kill our enemies wherever they are, you're definitely creating a much less stable world order. So they're huge issues. So I think, the starting question is to be careful what we wish for. Mm-hmm. What is the sort of world we're creating by introducing this technology and this set of rules to govern it?
Let's go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to weigh in on this topic. We'll start in Greenfield, where Nick joins us. Nick, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to talk about was a recent disclosure by this gentleman, Snowden, where he disclosed the government eavesdropping on individual telephone calls. I didn't have too much of a problem with that. But then when he leaked that the U.S. government was listening to foreign governments, that was not needed for people like ourselves walking up and down the street and going to work every day, that for the average citizen, that wasn't necessary information because our government was kind of just taking the position that, what some of those other governments were saying to us to our face and what they were saying to us about behind our backs was beneficial to us. And I don't think that he needed to leak that. And I felt that when he leaked that, that was an act of treason.
Nick, thanks for the call. Scott Horton?
Well, I think, it doesn't come as a shock to anybody in the world that the U.S. spies on other governments. All governments spy on other governments. So no huge a shock there. You know, what was, I think, a big problem in connection with these disclosures was systematic spying on our closest allies. So it created great problems in Germany when it was disclosed that the NSA was tapping the phone of Angela Merkel, the chancellor, and 130 other very senior political figures, and it was doing this on German soil using German facilities. So that was a huge issue, and I think there are very serious policy questions surrounding why that was being done. It certainly was very, very damaging to our relationship. Of course, whenever we have these whistleblowers out there disclosing things, you know, we instantly have a tendency in the American public to say either they're heroes and angels or they're traitors, they betrayed the country. I think what's much more, and that question becomes very emotional and very heated and tends to obscure actually looking at the information that's been revealed. In my mind, the real key question is, you know, have they revealed information that's very helpful to American citizens in understanding what their government has done and that leads Americans to form a different view about government activities and perhaps a more critical view? If they've done that, then they've served an important public cause. And I think, you know, in the case of Snowden, it's clear that there's a lot of very, very useful and interesting information that's come out. But we also have to say that, you know, Snowden actually didn't disclose any of these things himself. He turned things over to media organizations, and it's, you know, organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, that have made the decisions about which materials to publish. So if somebody's a traitor, it's our newspapers and broadcasters who are traitors.
Well, let's talk about the role of the media. We had an emailer, Dan, from Milwaukee, who wants to know what's the effect of something, say, like right-wing radio, for example. We have the internet. We have the 24-hour news cycle. It seems like media as an instrument of policy has never been a bigger deal.
Well, I think that's all of that is really important. So, for the United States to have a proper democratic dialogue, you need the formation of opinions, and you need to have them articulated in a very robust way. But there does need to be a discussion left and right. It can't all just be within one bubble. And there needs to be the formation of a national consensus. And I think it's true that the internet, talk radio, cable news, to some extent, does fuel engaged discussion of major policy questions at a level that we haven't had before. But a big part of the problem with secrecy is engaging the government on these issues, because we really need to have government spokesmen participating and justifying their positions and activities. And what we've seen over and over again is because something has been classified as secret, they don't want to discuss it. And they cite tactical secrecy reasons for not discussing it. But of course, we need to have a discussion about the policy, not about the individual tactics.
Secrecy is deciding whether something is secret or not is up to the individual agency, and there's doesn't seem to be any oversight of that at all. Thus, the CIA, for example, can retroactively classify as top secret instructions on how to use a rotary telephone. So you have the absolute control of what's secret and what's not. And I would think you also have, and this goes back to how the media, and I think in some cases they allow themselves to be used in this way, but how the media is employed through the selective leaking of information to specific individuals, like this person's really in the know. Hey, I've got this juicy piece because I have this inside source and you don't have it. And so I'm releasing it and I'm going to get credit for this. There's the use of knowledge as power is also about how you selectively release information in order to influence public opinion and policy, isn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, two very important points there. I mean, the first one is, you know, the power to create secrets and the way that power is doled out and the absence of checks So government overseers of secrecy are routinely telling us, and by the way, we spend $11 billion a year keeping secrets, they're routinely telling us that more than half of all secrets created shouldn't be secrets. They're just ridiculous, right? So that costs a lot of money, and it also means that all sorts of information isn't available to the people for a discussion in real time as it needs to be.
And then there's a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, you talk about how contractors, you mentioned one fellow in particular who became an important source of information for the government, and he was just making it up. That's just, when I read that, I thought, holy cow. I mean, who's actually paying attention?
But that's right, and when there was a major litigation about that, we had the National Security Director put in an affidavit saying that extreme national security concerns precluded the release of any of this information. And the information was really how this individual, a gentleman named Montgomery, had defrauded the CIA and other intelligence agencies through a ridiculous scam that, you know, sophisticated people should have figured out very early on.
But it, again, though, you know, this goes to the human, a kind of a human tendency to want to believe information that coincides with your worldview rather than accepting contrary information. If you find something that fits what you think is true already, it's much easier to accept.
That's exactly how a confidence artist works on his mark. So the confidence artist figures out what the mark thinks, what the mark is predisposed to believe, and approaches the mark with exactly that line of reasoning. And what we've seen is that hucksters and charlatans have used the same tactic on the U.S. government many, many times in the last decade, and it has cost us billions of dollars and undermined our actual national security. You also talk about leaks and fake leaks. I think this is an important point. I mean, we see leaks in the press and the media every single day. But the great majority of these leaks are leaks that the government has planted, and they don't want to acknowledge that the government has put it out there, but the government has put it out in the form or in the guise of a leak. And frequently these government-placed leaks turn out not to be true, and this is a point where this congressional study of the CIA program that was just out, the most fascinating thing I thought in that entire report was its study of the routine, consistent placement of fake leaks with the media, which, you know, the reporters would just lap up and put out there. They use that to build their ties with an important CIA source. They had really no ability to check the accuracy of the information. Classified information is like that. It's very, very difficult to check. And it turns out in the end that this information was almost all false.
You know, that sounds like a tactic that could only be used once. You couldn't use it the second time with the same journalist. Well, you know what? We need to pause for just a moment. And actually, before we take our break, I want to get a phone call in. We've got Stuart with us from Minneapolis. Let's take that call first, and then we'll go to break. Stuart, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Last week, I went to a talk by an absolutely riveting fellow by the name of Trevor Paglen, and he is involved in the arts, but he's got an academic background in geography, and his work focuses on the geography of secrecy, for want of a better term. And I thought I knew some things about what we do, but the one thing that would totally flummox me, you know, he had a lot about how we move close to geostationary satellites. But he talked about Green Bank, West Virginia, where forever there's been a radio telescope. So the area is a radio frequency zero tolerance zone. But I think it's a National Recovery Agency has a facility there. And the true purpose of the radio frequency silence is that we have capabilities of getting radio broadcast that slip out of slip away from Earth and bounce off the moon. So we are actually incorporating our nearest solar system neighbor in our monitoring systems. Hmm. I just thought that was something new to me, and I have a feeling not many other people have any idea that we go to this extreme.
Well, there is certainly, obviously, the definition of secret means there's a lot that goes on that we don't know about. Stuart, thanks for the call. Let's go to break. We'll continue our conversation with Scott Horton in just a moment. 800-486-8655, the number to call to join our program. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook or Twitter and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott Horton is the author of that book, and he is my guest. We have phone callers who want to join the conversation. Let's go next to Pete in La Crosse. Pete, good afternoon.
Hi, John and Scott. A bit ago, one of the callers said that the news media didn't need to release information about government spying that was released by Edward Snowden. I'd like to take us back to 2004, when the New York Times uncovered that the Bush and Cheney administration had been spying on Americans without warrants, which at the time was considered illegal, and the New York Times was asked by the White House not to say anything until after the election, and the New York Times said, yeah, let's not say anything, and then a year later they brought this out. My point is, it was their job to bring this out, and if it had an effect on the election, so what? That's how democracy works. But the New York Times failed in doing their job, and I still don't subscribe to them or have anything to do with them because I think that was a breach of democracy.
Pete, thanks so much for your call. Scott Horton?
Well, in my book, I actually look at this question in some depth, particularly the New York Times, Washington Post, as publications, as well as the major broadcast media, and they all have to deal with this question. They're all presented with leaks regularly. They always go through a procedure of going to the government and saying, we have this information, and we're prepared to report it. Explain to us why you think national security precludes it from being reported. And if you look at the historical record, you'll see that the posture they assume, just as this case that Pete has cited, indicates, is a very conservative posture. I mean, if the government makes a very strong and emphatic case that this is going to undermine national security, then generally they don't go with the information, or they only go with it in a much later period when it's going to come out in some other source. My sense is that actually they tend to err in favor of the government very frequently. And I think that case of the disclosures from 2004 and a number of other disclosures that came out concerning programs are things where they would have been, in retrospect, have taken a quite reasonable position in disclosing it. I'll just give you one other example. President Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, spoke to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times and berated him for sitting on the information he had in advance of the invasion about the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy said, you thought you were doing us a favor. You weren't. It would have been much better if you'd gone with the story and blocked this stupidity.
That was a classic example of information key information not making it to the right people. One of the things that seems to me is the most likely outcome of all of this is that the credibility of the government itself becomes very questioned. People then feel disconnected, you develop some very serious trust issues because you're always suspicious that something's going on that is detrimental, but you don't know about it, even if there's nothing happening.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, famous American writer Ambrose Bierce defined diplomacy as the art of lying in the interest of your country. All governments tell untruths about things. And when you get into the national security area and the intelligence area, that happens a lot. Although I think the public expects that to a certain degree, it's been rather severe in the last few years. And I think a great example is the PRISM program that's come up here a couple of times already. And there we learned about the program, but we learned about it mostly through denials. So it was government representatives like General Alexander saying, we don't spy on individual Americans, we don't look into your phone calls, we don't look at your internet conversations. And that was being repeated by senior figures in Congress.
And then when the disclosures came out, I mean, one of the most fascinating things that came from Snowden was a set of briefing slides that the NSA had to train its own personnel about this program. And those briefing slides made completely clear from the very first slide that the public statements weren't true. They're just clear falsifications or attempts to mislead the public. And I think this episode has really damaged trust in the government in the United States. I think public opinion polling is showing that, you know, particularly with young people and internet-savvy people, that trust now is at an all-time low.
Well, trust in any information source these days. There's just the internet is just it's full of junk, and people just kind of pick and choose what they want to believe, and it's sometimes a real challenge to find out what's really happening, even if you have access to all the information. How do you interpret it? Let's go back to the phones, and Pepin from Milwaukee is with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess I've been following this for a long, long time, ever since 9/11 happened and that whole debacle with the Patriot Act. And what really worries me is not what's being done now, per se, but if, for example, somebody gets into the wrong position and uses the information that's being gathered to basically emplace a dictatorship, to me, at that point, there would be no way out of that situation. You can't organize any sort of resistance without, you know, do you see what I'm saying? I'm sorry.
No. Excellent point. I mean, what's the end game here? What's the danger? What's the ultimate thing that could go wrong if we don't make some changes? Scott Horton?
Well, this is a huge difference in public perception between the United States and Germany, if I can put it that way. So, you know, in the U.S., the government says, trust us, we're not going to abuse this information. And in Germany, that argument doesn't go down because, you know, most adult Germans, you know, certainly those who are my age or a little bit older, have experienced already twice during their lifetime how authoritarian governments took control, you know, the Nazis and then the communists. And these authoritarian governments made use of that huge database that was held by the government and used it to repress large parts of the population. So the Germans think, no, we don't trust the government. And that, by the way, is also what our founding fathers told us. You know, particularly Thomas Jefferson said, don't trust the government. Bind them down by chains of the Constitution and limit their ability to collect information and data on individual citizens. So this is hardwired into our Constitution, I think. And in view of that, it's rather alarming that things have gotten as far as they've gotten. And we're seeing some pushback now, but it's mighty small.
Well, and then there's the concern on the part of many that it really isn't even the government making decisions anymore. There are people who aren't even in the government who wield a tremendous amount of influence and pretty much get whatever they want. People feel hopeless about being able to make any significant changes, and that seems kind of dangerous as well.
And this is what political scientists call the dual state theory, you know, that we have the sort of government that everybody reads about in their civics textbooks, you know, the Congress and the president and checks and balances and all of that. And then we have a real government behind that, which is an institutionalized bureaucracy, which is there, and it doesn't matter whether the Democrats or Republicans are in control of Congress. Those same bureaucrats and the same bureaucratic leaders run the major bureaucracies that make up the core of our government. And that provides, you know, a measure of static government, which is good in some sense, but it's outside of the democratic process. And I think what we're seeing in America today, particularly in this national security sector, is that our elected and democratic government counts for less and less, and this bureaucracy is more and more powerful and is the entity that is making more and more of the vital decisions that used to be made by the citizens.
Here's a comment from John on Facebook. Scott Horton, I'd like to get your response to this. John writes, conversations like this go nowhere. It is in the nature of the mass system for tasks to be divided into specialties, then further divided and subdivided, so that entities emerge to organize and administer those tasks. As these isolated entities get larger, they become insular and secretive, citing the necessity to protect proprietary information or enable them to perform their required tasks.
Yeah, well, of course, this is the thesis, what's called Robert Mickle's theory of the iron law of oligarchy, that it's necessary that we have these bureaucratic entities, that they grow over time, and that a technocratically experienced elite comes to the top and runs them. And the question is, you know, how you meld that into a democratic society and hold it in check so that the actual decision makers are the people, rather, you know, either directly or indirectly through their representatives. So it's certainly a vital issue. But I would agree with the with your writer here that these basic facts about the way bureaucracies develop is a key issue here. And this also helps explain why, in a sense, there's nothing sinister or conspiratorial about it. It's the nature of the beast of any bureaucracy that it will behave this way. But that only means that we have to take that into account in fashioning remedies.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call here. Peter is with us from Milwaukee. Peter, go ahead.
I'm a former Army officer. I commanded 14 tanks, and two of my family trees served George Washington's army during the Revolution. So no man can call me unpatriotic. When I was a boy, I read a lot of Sherlock Holmes, all of them, and I learned how to think for myself. And the strange events of 11 September 2001 do not make sense to me and are still wrapped in secrecy. There's no airliner evidence of an airliner hitting the Pentagon on 11 September 2001. There are no Google images. The lawn isn't even burned.
Okay, we get it. This is a great example of how people have lost some faith in their government because there are all of these conspiracy theories out there.
Well, I think they're to some extent not even conspiracy theories. So when we say that there are still too many secrets held about 9/11, in the last 48 hours, we've seen very clear evidence of precisely that. As information has come forward about suppressed portions of the 9/11 Commission report that discussed the financing role of Saudi princes in supporting Al-Qaeda and some of these conspiracies. So, yes, the government put great claims of secrecy over vital information surrounding that incident, and, you know, much of it is still now struggling to come out. And with the 9/11, with the SSCI report, we also had another key fact that had been suppressed from the 9/11 Commission report, which was that the CIA had information surrounding some of these conspirators coming to the United States, failed to provide that information to the FBI, and then lied to Congress in the 9/11 Commission about that. So here we have, just in the course of the last 6 or 7 weeks, vital information that relates to what happened on 9/11 finally coming out, and that information having been suppressed through the use of secrecy classifications.
We have about a minute and a half left. What do we need to do? How do we fix this problem?
The main thing is being aware of the problem, focused on it, and having collecting information about national security matters and having a viewpoint about these things, showing your elected officials that you care about these matters and that your vote will be driven by them. So we have to ensure that this plays a vibrant role in our democracy and that our elected leaders realize that the people care about national security issues and will make their vote according to their views.
But so many don't vote, and so many people have just kind of decided, you know what, there's nothing I can do. The heck with it. I don't even know if I'm going to have enough money to buy dinner tonight. I really don't care about all this other stuff.
But secrecy is a narcotic, I think. That is also clear. So the less information people have, the less they're concerned, the less they express interest about these things. So disclosures, and I have to say, leaks wind up being a vital stimulant in Americans' democratic dialogue and always have been.
Bread and circuses. Bread and circuses. That's what it sounds like sometimes when you watch the news and read the paper. Thank you so much, Scott Horton, for this interesting book and for coming on the air to talk with us about this vital issue today. I really appreciate your time.
Great pleasure.
Scott Horton is the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, published by Nation Books. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley. We had on-air production help today from Lisa Nalbandian and Scott Myers. Kathleen Dunn is back on Monday with All Things Political at 1 o'clock, so be sure to welcome her warmly from her vacation. And my thanks this last 2 weeks to K.P. and Scott and Lisa for all the great work that they've done to help me with these shows, and to you for calling and posting on Facebook and sending your emails. Couldn't do it without you. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.